Well, we can't get out of here. Me coming from Texas without first having a joke or two from Texas, I wouldn't think that would be right. You may have heard of a cowboy one time that rode into town and stopped at a saloon for a drink. Unfortunately, the locals there always had a habit of picking on strangers, which he happened to be. When he finished his drink, he found his horse had been stolen. He went into the bar, handily flipped his gun into the air, caught it above his head, and without even looking, fired a shot into the ceiling. "Which one of you sidewinders stole my horse?" He yelled that out with surprising force, and nobody answered. "All right, I'm going to have another beer, and if my horse ain't back outside, by the time I finish, I'm going to do what I'd done in Texas, and I don't like having to do what I'd done in Texas." Well, some of the locals shifted kind of restlessly, a little bit afraid what that meant. So the man, true to his word, had another beer, walked outside, and his horse had been returned to the hitching post. Well, he saddled up and started to ride out of town. Well, the bartender wandered out of the bar and asked, "Well, say, partner, before you go, what happened in Texas anyway?" The cowboy turned back and said, "I had to walk home. I don't want to do what I'd done in Texas, that's for sure." A Texas state trooper pulled over an old dusty pickup driven by a cowhand from a nearby ranch as he headed east on I-10. The trooper pulled him over and he asked, "Got any ID?" The cowboy replied, "About what?" Maybe you have to be from Texas to know that. Well, I don't know how wise it is of me to bring this particular subject here today, but I've decided to speak on wisdom. I thought that would be humorous, actually. Apparently, it was not very wise to begin that way, apparently. How many times in the last year or recently have we all said, well, speaking of ourselves, "Well, that wasn't very wise. Why did I do that? Why did I take this action or say this? Why did I do that?" And we've all said, sometimes even about serious things, "Boy, I sure wish I could go back and do that one over again." Unfortunately, we've all said that too as well. We all have all said that one way or another, because no one can always foresee what is going to result. None of us have that perfect insight and understanding to know exactly how everything's going to always work out perfectly. Nobody can do that. But the Bible does speak about one very important aspect of our lives. It's not doctrine, it's not faith, but it's the subject of wisdom. The important subject of wisdom. Now, what is that exactly? What is wisdom? Well, we'll go to the Bible and we'll see that before long, but why don't we just let some children tell us what wisdom is. They know. Patrick, age 10, says, "Wisdom is to never trust a dog to watch your food." That won't work. Not very wise to let your dog watch your plate for you. Michael, age 14, says, "When your dad is mad and asks you, 'Do I look stupid?' don't answer." That's wisdom right there. John, age 13, says, "Never tell your mom her diet's not working." Unwise to do that. Another child, age 9, said, "Never hold a dustbuster and a cat at the same time." That's unwise. Finally, Naomi, 15, says, "If you want a kitten, start out asking for a pony." "Dad, can I have a pony?" "No." "I want a pony." "No." "Well, can I at least have a cat?" "Oh, all right." It'll probably work that way. One individual said, a colleague of mine at NASA was assigned to prepare a presentation on lessons learned from our bad experience with the Hubble Space Telescope. Years ago, when I was here, we had a gentleman that worked at on the Hubble Space Telescope and tried to correct some of the problems they had earlier on. But one individual was asked, "Well, what lesson did you learn about the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the difficulties?" And on his chart at the briefing, he had lesson number one, and it read, in naming your mission, never use a word that rhymes with trouble. That would have been the wisdom on naming the Hubble. A minister gave an unusual sermon one day using a peanut to make several important points about the wisdom of God in nature, which seemed to work. Well, one of the members greeted him at the door and said, very interesting, Pastor. I never expected to learn so much from a nut. That maybe wasn't the wisest way to put that compliment. All right, what's the real definition of wisdom? A real definition, the ability to discern or judge what is true, right, or lasting. It's insight. The Bible talks about the important aspect of wisdom, having some insight, common sense, good judgment. Now, here's the difference in these three terms. First of all, there is knowledge. Knowledge would be the facts. You know what the facts are about something. And that would be classified as information. And what do? You commit information to your memory. You remember the facts, the information. And you, if you knew a lot about that, you might be called a scholar. Now that's different from understanding. Knowledge is different from understanding because understanding would be you not only know the facts, but you know what they mean. Okay, you can quote the facts. What do they really mean? And so you learn principles, not just information. You learn about principles. And so you don't just commit something to memory. You start using reason. You reason around these principles and apply them. And instead of just being a scholar, you know a lot of facts. You can write a book. You might be considered to be a teacher. You can now begin to teach others about how to reason based on what things mean. And then you have wisdom, because wisdom takes the facts and you even have the meaning, but it tells you what to do next. Okay, what should I do or not do? It's the application of the principle and the facts. So it doesn't involve only memorizing something or even using your reason. It has to do with the action you take. Wisdom guides your action, and so you might not just be a scholar, you might not be a teacher, you might be referred to as, well, maybe a prophet or a wise sage. Go to him. He'll tell you what to do. Go to the teacher, he'll tell you what the principle or the scholar or the fact, but the other one will tell you, look, here's what you need to do now or not do. Remember Proverbs 26? Verse 4 and 5 seems to be a contradiction. It says, answer not a fool according to his folly, or else you're going to end up being just like him. And then the very next verse says, well, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. Sounds like a direct contradiction of the very same thing. Okay, you've got the facts, or the fool is stating the facts, but now you've got to use some wisdom. Is now the time to answer? Is now the time to get into something? Should I just let what this fool is saying go because it doesn't amount to anything? It'll only stir something up. Or is it the time to say, wait a minute, hold on, that doesn't make any sense. That's not right. No, I don't see it that way. When is the right time to do that? Well, you need a little bit of wisdom, don't you? You need some wisdom to know, well, this is the right thing to do or not to do. Well, why don't we look at the very classic example in the Bible that has to do with wisdom, and we find that in 1 Kings chapter 3. Let's spend a little bit of time here, 1 Kings chapter 3, or at least in 1 Kings. Here is the time of Solomon, and Solomon did something that was very pleasing to God, beginning in verse 5. First Kings chapter 3, verse 5. Now here it was in Gibeon that the Lord appeared unto Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask whatever you want, and I'll give it to you. And Solomon said, you've shown unto your servant David my father great mercy, according as he walked before you in truth, in righteousness and uprightness, his heart was with you and have kept from him this great kindness that you have given to his son, to me, to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of David my father. I'm but a little child. I don't know how to go. I don't know what to do always. I don't know how to lead these people. I don't feel like I'm a king. I don't feel prepared for this. Your servant is in the midst of the people which you have chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered and counted for. I just don't know if I know what to do. How am I going to lead these people? So please give therefore your servant an understanding heart so I can judge your people, so I can make right decisions. I could create a lot of problems on my own, that I may discern between the good and the bad. And for who's able to judge this so great a people? Well, obviously that speech pleased God that Solomon asked for this thing. So God granted him wisdom. The important point here is that Solomon got his wisdom from God. The wisdom came from God. And that is the key for us to remember as we continue throughout this message here this afternoon. So the wisdom came from God. God was very pleased that he asked it. Now let's go down to verse 16, because we have here, of course, the classical biblical account of the great wisdom of Solomon. So we have here two ladies, it says in verse 16. Then came there two women that were harlots. So whether they were practicing that now or not is not always clear, but it says that's indeed what they were. And they came unto the king and they stood before him. So here were two ladies that apparently kept a public inn. People would travel and they'd stop in here in the inn. Exactly what services were provided, it doesn't say, but at least this was their profession at one point. So they had this kind of business going, the two of them, and they were the only ones that were there. And probably, just to kind of read between the lines, they may have presented their case before what we would call a lower court, and nobody could figure out what to do, so it worked its way up to Solomon. Now he's presented with the case that it's going to be described here. And the one woman said, now you don't know which woman this is just by reading this. You don't know whether it's the woman that was wronged, or you don't know whether it's the woman that's making it up because she wants to present herself as being wronged. Really not easy to know exactly. But anyway, this woman speaks first and says, "Oh my Lord, I and this woman dwelt in one house, and I had a child with her in the house. I had my baby, and it came to pass 3 days later after I was delivered, this woman also had a child. We both did. We were together. There wasn't anybody else in the house. We're all alone. There's no witnesses to anything. We're together, no stranger with us in the house except the two of us. Now, this woman's child died in the night." Well, was it that true or was it her own? We don't really know. "This woman's child died in the night because she apparently rolled over and suffocated the child. Well, she gets up in the middle of the night and takes my son from beside me while your handmaid slept and took that child and laid it beside her and put the dead child by me. So when I get up in the morning to nurse my child, I had a dead child on my hands, but when I had considered it in the morning, that wasn't my child at all. Look what she did here, Your Honor," or Solomon. "Well," the other woman said, "hold on just a minute here. No, the living is my son, the dead is your son." And then that one said, "No." Now it's kind of interesting, the response here, because this woman says, "Oh no, the living one is my son, you've got the dead one." Now the other one doesn't say, "Oh no, you don't, the living one's my son, you've got the dead one." She reverses it. She says, "But the dead one is your son, the living one is mine." So there might be an indication of what is important to each one of them just by that response. Hard to say. But here's King Solomon. What's he going to do about it? How does he know what to do? Probably why it ended up in front of him. "Well, then said the king, the one says, this is my son that lives and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead and my son lives." Now, it's always wise for a counselor to repeat. He's repeating what the story is. Here's what you two are claiming, he says. So the king says, somebody get a sword here. We need a sword over here. So they brought him the sword before the king. And the king says, okay, we'll divide the living child in two and give half to the one and half to the other. Well, then spoke the woman whose the living child really was. And she said to the king, for inside her, of course, her motherly instincts yearned upon her son. And she says, oh, my Lord, give her the living child and in no wise slay it. But the other one says, let it neither be mine nor yours, but divide it. Well, it doesn't take a whole lot of wisdom at this point to know what's going on. Because it became very, very clear. You see, the one had the love for the child that was living. And the other one didn't care about the child. She just didn't want the other woman to have what she didn't have. So it seemed to become clear what was going on in this case. And then the king answered and said, no, give her the living child. In no way slay it. She's the mother thereof. Now, all of us probably could have figured that out at that moment. But would we have been able to have had the wisdom to know how to do that Solomon did? He realized, I think I know how I can see. After he's listening, now he would listen, and he would look at their face, and he would listen to what they're having to say and try to make some discernment, but he has to bring it out. He has to find a way to bring this out so that they show themselves. That's where the wisdom came in, because once they did, probably most of us would have probably figured out, I think I can see who really cares and who doesn't. So this is kind of the classic example in where it says, and all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged, and they feared the king because they said, God's given this man special help and wisdom. For they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to do judgment. It was God's wisdom, not somebody else's. So the lying mother didn't really want the child, but Solomon kind of tricked her into showing what was really in her heart. Now we all realize that some wisdom comes just through age. You live and you learn. We all live and learn. It says that in Job 12 and verse 12, with the ancient is wisdom, and in length of days is understanding. We learn through experience. Sometimes we might say that we mellow. A lot of times parents will be that way. They'll look back on their children and the first one got a special attention, and by the time you got to child number 5, your child rearing approach seems to have changed. So sometimes it may mellow that way, or maybe not quite as exacting and having everything perfect and hoping to have this perfect child. But sometimes it goes the other way, because you learn and you wise up. You learn not to be so gullible. You learn not to be fooled so easily, because you've learned some lessons. And it goes both ways. So we all learn sometimes through experience. Luke chapter 2 and verse 52, it even tells us Jesus learned over time. He learned as he grew. It says in Luke 2:52, Jesus increased in wisdom. Now, if you increase in wisdom, you must have more at one point than you had at an earlier point. Well, naturally, he had more wisdom at age 12 than he had at age 6, and he had more at age 30 than he had at age 12. He grew and increased in wisdom and his own stature, his own maturity, his own development. And, of course, was in favor always with God and with people. He respected him. Now, there is the one story that's told about a new bank president took over the presidency of a bank, and he met with his predecessor, and he said, I would like to know, what have been the keys to your success? I'm taking over as president of the bank, and you've been here for a long, long time. What are the keys to your success? The older gentleman looked at him and replied, young man, I can sum it up in 2 words. Good decisions. Good decisions. To that young man replied, well, I thank you very much for that advice, sir, but How does one come to know which are the good decisions? That's the question. He said, not one word, replied the gentleman. He said, experience leads you to good decisions. He said, well, that's well and good, the younger man said, but how does one get experience? He says two words, bad decisions. That's how you come to the experience and eventually come to the good ones. Everybody makes some bad decisions, and wisdom comes with age. That happens naturally. But we want more than that, don't we? Don't we want to just wait around till we're older so we can learn things? God doesn't want to just wait around till we're older. What is the source of our wisdom? 1 Corinthians 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 19. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Well, there is a wisdom in the world, in a sense. For it's written, he takes the wise in their own craftiness, and again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they're vain. Therefore, let no man glory in men, for all things are yours. For the wisdom of the world. Now, that reminds us, doesn't it, of Luke chapter 16? Luke 16 and this parable of what's called the unjust steward. Why don't we look at that briefly? Luke chapter 16, verse 1. Jesus said to his disciples, there happened to be a very wealthy man, and he had somebody that kept his books and took care of the financial aspect of his empire for him and his holdings. And that man happened to be accused that he had wasted his goods and been irresponsible, and apparently turned out to be true. So the rich man called him and said unto him, well, what's all this that I hear about you? I've checked into it, and it's true. So you better give an account of your stewardship, for you're fired. You got 2 weeks. Well, the steward said, wow, my reputation's gone. I'll never pick up another job in this field anymore. Now what am I going to do? He's taken away from me the stewardship, and I'm certainly not going to go out and do manual labor. And I'm not going to stand and beg. That's too demeaning. He says, I think I've got a great idea. As a matter of fact, I do. I know what I'll do, and when I'm put out of the stewardship, they'll receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors, and he said unto the first one, oh, how much you owe? Oh, well, he said, 100 measures of oil, pretty good amount. He said, well, look, take the bill, sit down quickly, and write 50, cut it out. Well, say, thanks a lot. Appreciate that. Now, don't think about it, no problem. Just cut it in half. Said to the other one, how much you owe? And he said, well, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, take your bill and write 80. Make it 80. Well, thanks a lot. I won't forget you. Appreciate that. Well, then it says in verse 8, his boss, the rich man, it doesn't mean Jesus here. It means the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. He at least said, well, you know, I've got to hand it to you. If you're talking about being crafty, you're talking about being creative and kind of wily and cunning, I got to hand it to you, because when you're out, you got some folks that are going to receive you and give you a break and help you out. But of course, that isn't the right thing to do. But Jesus then said, for the children of this world are in their generation, in this world, in this context, in what we see around us, there's a lot of really crafty, pretty smart people that get done what they need to be done, whether it's in business or politics or what have you. And they really are. They really use their resources. Not ethically always, of course, but they do get it done. But we need to be wise in the way that God would have us to be wise. We certainly see that in the political scene now. And the whole thrust is get the votes. Get people to vote for you. And so it's not always the most ethical, the most forthright, the most straightforward. This is me. This is my message. This is what it's. What do I need to say that impresses the most and gets the most support? That's the effort. Of course, that sooner or later ends up working against someone because someone else does it to them, or the whole population loses confidence in the whole system. You get fed up with it because you just don't feel like it's always forthright and honest. And somebody's who they are, and they do what they say they're going to do, and that's just the political scene in the way it is. But they use the wisdom of the world, and they do get elected often. There's a temporary reward. Godly wisdom says, of course, in the parable, to use the funds to produce an everlasting reward, a wise use of it. Let's go to James chapter 3. James chapter 3. We'll begin in verse 13 through 17. James said, "Well, who is a wise man? He's got knowledge and knows what to do among all of you. Let him show out a good conduct, his works with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above." There's a wisdom from above, and there's a wisdom that everybody uses on a daily basis that's of the world. "For where envy and strife is, there's confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy, good fruits without partiality, without hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace." The wisdom from above produces certain fruits. It's wisdom based on God's way. It's wisdom based on right values, right principles. And when you talk about the whole political scene, our fundamental problem, I think if they were to ask candidates, "Well, what do you think is the number one problem in America?" "Oh, the economy." "Oh, it's a threat from Iran." "Oh, it's this, that, or the other thing." And those things may be very, very important indeed. But is that really the number one threat? I'd like to take a minute, maybe 2-3 minutes, and read an article from an individual. His name is Walter E. Williams. He writes articles and commentary. And I think it's important for us to contemplate this, because to me it kind of gets to the heart of what is the real problem, and do people have the wisdom to see this and to recognize it? So Mr. Williams, who's getting up there in age now, he says, "Having been born in 1936 has allowed me to witness both societal progress and retrogression. High on the list of things that made better in our society are the great gains in civil liberties and economic opportunities, especially for racial minorities and women. People who are now deemed poor have a level of material wealth that would have been a pipe dream to yesterday's poor. But despite the fact that today's Americans have achieved an unprecedented level of prosperity, we have become spiritually and morally impoverished compared to our ancestors. Years ago, spending beyond one's means was considered a character defect. Today, not only do people spend beyond their means, but also there are companies that advertise on radio and TV to eliminate or reduce your credit card and mortgage debt. Students saddled with college loans have called for student loan forgiveness. Yesterday's Americans would have viewed it as morally corrupt and reprehensible to accumulate debt and then seek to avoid paying it. They just would not have wanted to be that kind of person. They have their responsibility. I'll take care of my responsibility. It's nothing less than theft. What's worse is there's little condemnation of it by the rest of us. Earlier this year, as the result of a budget crunch, the Philadelphia School District had to lay off 91 school police officers. During the 1940s and 50s, I attended Philadelphia schools in poor neighborhoods. The only time we saw a policeman in school was during an assembly period when we had to listen to a boring lecture about safety. Because teacher assaults are tolerated, 4,000 over the past 5 years in Philadelphia, 4,000 teacher assaults. School police are needed. Prior to the 1960s, few students would have thought of talking back to a teacher. No one would have cursed, much less assault a teacher. I couldn't have been more than 8, 9, or 10 years old when one time, on the way home from school, my cousin and I were having a stone fight with some other youngsters. An elderly black lady walked up to my cousin and me and asked, "Does your mother know you're out there throwing stones?" We replied, "Well, no, ma'am," praying that the matter rested there. Today, an adult doing the same thing risks being cursed and possibly assaulted. Fearing retaliations, adults sit in silence, as young people use vile language to one another on public conveyances, in school corridors, and on the streets. Yesteryear, there was little tolerance for kids of crude behavior and language that are acceptable today. To see a man sitting on a bus or trolley car while a woman is standing used to be unthinkable. Children didn't address adults by their first name. By the way, over the course of my nearly 45 years of teaching, on several occasions, students have addressed me by my first name. I have told them that I do not mind their addressing me by my first name, but that my first name is Professor. Much of what's accepted today would have been seen as bizarre and low down yesteryear. Out of wedlock children was a disgrace and surely wouldn't have been occasioned by a baby shower. Popular TV shows such as Jerry Springer Show and Maury, featuring guests who openly discuss despicable acts in their personal lives, often to the applause of the audience, shame is going the way of the dinosaur. You say, "Williams, you're just old-fashioned and out of touch with modern society." Well, maybe so. But I think that a society's first line of defense is not the law, but customs, traditions, and moral values. These behavioral norms transmitted by example, word of mouth, religious teaching, rules of etiquette, and manners represent a body of wisdom distilled over the ages through the experience and trial and error. There's a wisdom in this right behavior. We know what it produces. We know the problems that come. They include important legal thou shall not, such as you shall not murder, shall steal, lie, or cheat. But they also include all those civilities that one might call ladylike or gentlemanly behavior. Police officers and courts can never replace these social restraints on personal conduct. At best, laws, police, and criminal justice system are a society's last desperate line of defense. I thought that was very insightful. I think he has a lot of wisdom in thinking about what's really going on, what's really at the heart. Is it really Iran? Is it the budget? Those are important, but is something else? Should we have the wisdom to grasp there's something else that's a threat, a very serious threat? Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 8. For to one is given by the Spirit the word of wisdom, to another the word of knowledge, and so on. Some people have more wisdom than others. And sometimes it comes partly by nature, also from God, but some have more wisdom than others. That's why James said, if any of you lack wisdom, why don't you ask God to help you grow in wisdom, make better decisions, have better judgment. So on what is our life based when we think about the question? We're going to make thousands of decisions in our life. Thousands of decisions over our lifetime. On what do we base those decisions? What is our foundation? What do we use to try to call upon to say, well, should I or should I not? Well, Psalm 111, verse 10. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Well, now you begin to believe there is a God. God does have a way. God does have a plan. He does have a sense of what is of value, what is right and wrong. And when a person finally comes to that, they begin to, okay, I accept there's a God. God's called me for a purpose. I'm to be fulfilling something. I'm to be going forward. I'm to be growing. Now you're starting to wise up. Now you're starting to get some wisdom. You'll find your life starting to stabilize, and it's starting to put good decisions one after the other. Whereas if you're following, well, this is what everybody else is doing, you end up one dumb move after another. It just doesn't work very well if it's not based on godly principles, and which is the foundation of good choices. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 7. 1 Corinthians 2, 7. It says, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom." Oh, God's wisdom is really hidden. Everybody doesn't always see it. Everybody doesn't grasp it. It's called a mystery. It's hidden. So you're not going to come up with it on your own. Oh yes, when we get older, we're probably going to learn some things about life. You'll grow in wisdom. That happens with pretty much everybody. But I mean the important things. It's a mystery. It's hidden wisdom. You're not going to come up with it. That's why our society in general doesn't see what's going on. Like Mr. Williams said, well, it's a certain wisdom that comes that you project to the next, you pass on wisdom to the next generation. Well, we're rapidly discarding whatever the previous generations held as important. Very unwise. Or at least to know the difference of what you discard and what you do not. So what should be some tips for us in making wise decisions? Let me pass on a few points to you. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15. Proverbs 12, 15. "The way of the fool is right in his own eyes, but he that hearkens unto counsel is wise." So one way to make good decisions, to be wise, is to get some advice, get some counsel, get some input from others. Now one individual said, well, the trouble with good advice is that it usually interferes with your plans. Because most all of us have things we want to do, and we have it in our mind what we really want to do, and sometimes we're reluctant to hear from somebody else because they're going to tell you, that isn't a very good thing to do, that isn't a very wise thing to do. And so we often already figure out, I think I'll avoid that, and we don't bother because we know what we want to do, feel strongly about it or desire it, and so we go ahead with what we think. So it's always good to get advice, get some counsel, get somebody else to reflect upon that and to help you consider it. It'll help you make better decisions. It's wisdom to get counsel about what's wise. Point number two in making good decisions, we have to analyze our motive. Analyze your motive. What's driving this? Why are you wanting this? What's at the heart of it? Sometimes we're not always in touch with that. And there's a reason that we're making a decision. There's a reason we're doing what we're doing or contemplating that. What's our motive? What are we trying to accomplish? Is it a right motive? Because that'll make a big difference. Point number three, watch your emotions. What emotions are at work? Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9. "Be not hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools." You're quick. You're too quick. You run off by emotions. There's something very important for every child to develop. That's why we send them to school. They need to develop intellectually. They need to learn how to read and to write. They need to learn how to reason. Their mind needs to develop. They need to grow, but there's also the importance of emotional development. They need to learn how to deal with their emotions, which are a powerful part of our life. There's certain things we do, certain things we don't do. We don't just allow ourselves all of our emotional outbursts. We teach children, certainly there's times when we cry, there's times when we're excited, there's times when we yell, there's times when we're happy, but there's times when we're quiet, there's times when we don't do certain things. We restrain ourselves. We're in church, or we're at school, or we're somewhere else, or we're in an environment. We don't do that. And you learn to exercise your emotional impulses and develop emotional maturity, just like intellectual maturity. But often that's downplayed very much today. And, well, you just let them go on and, well, they're kids. Well, sure they are, but they need to learn at a proper age, depending what age they are, how to begin to deal with their emotions and their outbursts. We don't emphasize that quite as I think it was in the past. But of course, in the past, a lot of times people's emotions, which were honest and real, were suppressed when they needed to be expressed. So we go from one extreme to the other often. Another tip on making good decisions: get the facts. Get the facts before we launch into a decision. Don't assume more than you should. Remember the account in ancient Israel when they crossed over the Jordan and you had, what was it, half-tribe Manasseh and Gad. They stayed on the east side of the Jordan. Remember that? And then they went over, they helped them conquer, and then they went back. And when they went back to the east side of the Jordan, they set up like a stone monument. And word spread through Israel, they're setting up an altar. They're going to be worshiping a false god. So they get your weapons and they got their armies and they were going to go crush half tribe Manasseh and Gad because here they're already worshiping a false god with this altar. And so it was they barely got saved because they were going to attack them and kill them. They're, well, what are you doing here? Well, you're erecting an altar. We're not doing that at all. We're setting up a monument to honor God, for He's given us the land, and so on. Oh, well, we didn't realize that. Well, why didn't you come and find out first? All you had to do is send somebody and check it out. Here, you're all armed. You got the whole army mobilized, and we're going to be dead here. Completely wrong. They were all stirred up about it and driven in a very unwise way. So you have to get the facts. Make sure you understand the circumstances. That will help a lot. And especially when you hear a story from one person, always try to get the perspective coming from the other direction. And it always, virtually always, changes your initial summation and judgment that you come to. Try to get all of the facts. That's important. Another tip: do not be asking God for signs before you make your decision. You're about to buy a car and you go up to the dealer. God, if the salesman comes out and says, boy, do I have a deal for you today, don't take that as a sign that you've got a deal today. Don't put God in some kind of spot where He now is responsible to you to respond to you the way you've set it up for Him to respond. Now, sure, we all try to look for indicators. We've all felt at times, I think God blessed me. I think something happened here. I think a door was opened. I think it seems obvious. I'm thanking God because I don't think this would have worked out. Well, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with praying and say, well, God, help me and guide me in my decision. Help me to see the factors that will bring a right decision. But don't set up a certain set of circumstances that now God has to then respond exactly the way you set it up. If He comes out and says, we got a sale today, that's my sign, from you that I'm to buy the car today. You can get yourself into trouble that way. God doesn't feel a responsibility for you to define how He's going to lead you and direct you that way. That's too restrictive on it. And finally then, the final tip, be sure to ask, and maybe this could be tip number one, I just leave it for the last to emphasize it, always ask God's guidance, of course. Proverbs chapter 3, let's read that. Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. God will come through. If we can trust in God with all our heart, He'll come through in His way. Don't just lean to your own understanding. Now, there's some very important spiritual lessons in that, because a lot of people have been around a long time. I know the Bible. I know what God says. Well, I know this. And we begin to rest upon and rely upon past experiences. Well, I know what's happening here. And I'd heard that in the past before. I remember several saying that to me in 1995. Oh, we saw this back in 1974. We've seen this same old thing. Well, this is not the same thing. This isn't exactly the same thing. And that's happened more recently. Well, we've seen this before. I said, this is not the same thing. This is different. So you can rely on your own understanding. Don't go very far doing that. Trust in God with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He'll direct your paths. Ever do something and say, that was not my best decision. That wouldn't work out. And you think back, you know, I never bothered. I didn't pray. I didn't ask for any guidance. I thought I knew. I've been around. I know this, that, and the other thing. And it might have made a big difference to say, well, help and guide me. But you didn't do that. Didn't think you needed to. So that's an important principle. Ask for God's guidance. What do you think is the worst decision in all history? What's the worst decision in all of history? Well, I don't know that the Bible actually categorizes it. I'll just say Adam and Eve eat the fruit. Well, pretty bad move there. Pretty bad decision. What did they do? Violated everything I said not to do, didn't they? Set the course of all human history, Adam and Eve. Well, what would be another one? Well, Judas helps the Sanhedrin know where they can find Jesus in the middle of the night. Bad move. Thought it was going to result in something that it didn't. Of course, later when he found out, he wanted to repent. He couldn't. He went and hanged himself. 30 pieces of silver. Very, very unwise decision. Well, there's some things coming in the future too. Beast and false prophet fight against Christ at His return. What do they say? Bad career move? Bad decision. Not going to work out. A lot of other people. There's a lot of important decisions coming up in the future, isn't there? Very important decisions. We want to make the right one as best we're able with God's help. So, yes, doctrine's important. Yes, faith is important. Got to have love. But the Bible talks about wisdom, doesn't it? The importance of having wisdom. Wise decisions, wise judgment. God's way is the foundation of having good judgment and wisdom. None of us have it perfectly. We're not Jesus. But God's way is that foundation. So we need to use good sense and ask for God's help. For departing from God's way is a dumb move. We'll just label it that. Departing from God, walking with God, is a bad move. It's a very unwise thing to do, and we always come back to that sooner or later. It's the bad thing to do. So we're either going to live by the wisdom from above, that comes from above, that is a mystery, that comes from God's revelation. We either live by that wisdom or from our own brilliant deductions. Which way do we want to go? What do we want to base it on? What's our foundation? Of course, the holy days and God's Word give the framework for sound-mindedness. The plan of God gives us sound-mindedness and helps us in our decisions. So let's always strive, of course, to have the truth, to have the love of God, to have faith, but also to strive to have the wisdom that is from above.